All right. Hi, everyone. I'm Keith Law.
Lindsay Adler.
Thank you all for coming tonight. We're going to just talk a little bit about my book, some of the stuff Lindsay's been working on for Deadspin for a few minutes. We'll try to leave the bulk of the time for questions. Kevin warned us that you might have a few. That's totally fine. I've done a few of these types of events before, and I'm very much used to it. So I'll just start by just talking a little bit. I see a few of you have copies of Smart Baseball. It came out about 2 months ago. And it was really the book that I wrote in response to readers asking me repeatedly for the last couple of years to recommend something that would allow them to get up to speed on the basics of sabermetrics. Not just the specific statistics, although those of you who've read the book have probably seen I do go into some specific stats, especially in the second section, but just this whole philosophy, the way of looking at players analytically or rationally, as opposed to the more traditional way of looking at players, which, and I don't mean just scouting, I talk about scouting in the book, and that still exists, but the way of looking at players using the stats that just aren't that good at it, the pitcher wins, the saves, the fielding percentage. Many of you here probably know those stats are garbage. You'd be surprised how much of the baseball audience across the country and a lot of members of the media still haven't accepted that those stats are garbage. And so I wanted to write a book that was accessible to the lay audience, that would answer as many questions as I possibly could, that would not assume too much on the part of the reader, that would not require much of a math or statistics background or even that deep of a baseball background, but that by the time everyone got to the end of the book, they would feel like they were all, that they could at least understand philosophically what a team was doing, what a manager was doing, why someone was arguing to say Mike Trout should be the MVP instead of Miguel Cabrera. You don't even necessarily have to agree with everything I'm saying in the book, but at least I'm giving you the foundation to be able to participate in these discussions, and again, maybe to better understand what you're seeing happening at the major league level, especially now with all 30 teams having established analytics departments, which wasn't true when I started writing the book, only became true for the first time last fall when Arizona and Minnesota changed regimes, set up analytics departments, and became the last two teams to get on board. Now, the argument I make is you don't have to know what all these stats mean to be a good baseball fan. You certainly don't have to calculate any of them, but the team you root for, whoever it is, they're probably doing some of this stuff. So if you want to be able to follow along with what the GM is saying, or just understand the moves they're making, let me at least give you the real foundations of that philosophy of understanding how teams are looking at players today.
So I have read the book, and I found it useful because I have a lot of friends who may enjoy baseball casually, but may not. I mean, a lot of people have said to me things like, I think I missed like a Sabermetrics 101 primer. And I think it's hard for a lot of people to cobble together like a true understanding of, you know, modern statistics just through the Fangraphs glossary, which is great, but it's not comprehensive. And so I've recommended Keith's book because I think it really, you know, it explains like the best way to measure things now, and also compares it to the things we're, you know, used to. The thing that really sticks out to me, thinking like my friends who would be reading this going into it, needing to be sold on statistics, is the run probability and stolen bases, and, you know, the kind of fashioning out of stolen bases. So maybe you should talk about that.
Yeah, which is, you know, aesthetically, I kind of miss the stolen base. Like, I'm a child of the 80s, so I remember Ricky Henderson breaking the record. I remember Tim Raines being essentially his rival. I still think part of why Raines took so long to get into the Hall was he was still being compared to Ricky, which is not fair. There's only one Ricky. And you don't have to be that good to actually get into the Hall. But I remember, you know, seeing league leaders who'd get up close to triple digits, Eric Davis stealing 80 bases. Like, that was exciting. It was exciting to watch, and it was exciting to see at the end of the season to see some of these totals. I regret that that's no longer a big part of the game, but I also understand why, and I wanted to be able to explain that too. And that to me is, although it is sabermetrically inclined, I mean, the idea of playing less small ball certainly stems from the same philosophy. This is not the same as just saying, hey, the way you used to think about baseball is stupid. I do say that a few times in the book, and I'm not sorry. But it's more that, look, the game has changed, and here's why. And maybe if you don't like what I'm saying about some of these old stats about other players early in the book, but let me explain to you why the stolen base has gone somewhat out of fashion, and why, you know, maybe why teams don't care so much if catchers can't throw like they used to be expected to throw. Maybe that's the way I can hook more people into thinking about baseball differently, because ultimately that's what I think, that's what I hope a lot of people will get out of this book. Maybe not necessarily folks in this room. You might be here because you were already thinking this way, but a lot of people weren't. And I've had a few people come back to me and say that was a chapter that really spoke to them, because it, again, it's less about just tearing down something old and instead saying there's a rational reason why people steal less. There's a rational reason why people, why teams bunt less than they used to, and why they should probably be bunting even less than they're bunting now. And so to be able to point that out in, I mean, that's about as mathy as the book gets. And I was comfortable with, I when I first pitched this to publishers too, I said, this is not gonna be a math book. You mentioned the Fangraphs glossaries. I think their site's great, but there's a lot of people I can't send those links to because I think it assumes too much. It assumes too much of a comfort level with formulas. And too much makes too many assumptions about what the reader's already gonna know. That's something I would send to an advanced reader. That's not what I wanted to do in the book. And the sections about the stolen base and about the sacrifice bunt, talking about, it's really, those of you who have taken any economics classes, it's expected value. It's just the expected value formula in a baseball context. I don't really talk about it in those terms, again, because I was trying to be as inclusive as possible, but that's all it is. Here's the probability of success and what that's worth, the probability of failure and what that costs you, and you add those up, and that's the value of this, say, of a stolen base attempt or of a bunt attempt. And that, again, that was something I wanted in that first section of the book, to feel a little, to give a different vibe from those chapters at the beginning that were really just tearing down parts of baseball history that needed to be torn down. But at the same time, to say, look, there's, whether you like this or not, this is the direction we're going as a sport. Every team is now thinking this way, and here are a couple of very concrete examples that you will see every time you watch a game with an explanation of why teams are behaving differently than they did 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Another thing I found interesting personally was that, you know, Keith talks about growing up taking things like batting average just as gospel because that's what it was. And I realized that I had never really thought to wonder where those statistics were coming from at all, or, you know, where they had come from to begin with. And I'd been telling Keith that I'm young enough that I have also taken a lot of, you know, sabermetrics in that sense. And so not only reading it, not only did I begin to, I guess, did it reaffirm my understanding of, you know, the old standbys being weak or incomplete, but also the statistics we have now that are commonly regarded as the good and smart ones. In that similar vein, I've put a lot of trust into those. What do you think is going to happen with those going forward?
When did you first encounter some of the more advanced stats? Because to be honest, like, it was around the time you were born was when I was first running into these, like the early 90s when I got to college and found Usenet. I mean, raise your hand if you're old enough to remember Usenet or Rec Sport Baseball. I mean, that's where this all started for me, and found people talking about this stuff. First, I was mad. Well, what do you mean Ken Hill isn't the best pitcher in the National League? He had the most wins. But they were, obviously, I came around to their way of thinking pretty quickly, but I had to actually change something that was kind of ingrained in me or had been indoctrinated in me over the previous, you know, 15 years or so of baseball fandom. You just made me curious, did you encounter that stuff young enough that it kind of all hit you at the same time?
I mean, I'm not enough of a stat head to say here is the point at which I encountered, I don't know.
You don't remember your first on-base percentage?
No, but I actually didn't really grow up learning baseball from my family or learning it from like an older male, you know, figure. So I didn't grow up with these ingrained ideas of batting average, pitcher wins. So, you know, there were points in your book where I was like, well, why is he railing so hard on this? I don't know that mentality. Yeah. You know, it was just, it became evident to me that, I guess, the generational gap in the mindset that I've grown up with became very evident to me because it was never a big dramatic thing for me to discover that there's life outside of pitcher wins.
You were asking before too, and I should just qualify too. My indoctrination really came from two sources. Newsday. I grew up on Long Island. Newsday was the daily paper, and the Yankees and Mets broadcasters. More Yankees. I grew up in a Yankee fan household. My parents are both born and raised in the Bronx, and I'm mostly Italian. The Yankees were very much the Italian team of the 40s and 50s. So whatever they said, whatever Phil Rizzuto and Frank Messer and Bill White said, that was just gospel. You just didn't really think twice about it. And so it was all of the, really, like I said, 15 years or so of baseball fandom that I had to kind of break down when I first started encountering some of these sabermetric arguments online. You were asking about where I think some of these advanced stats will be going forward. There's such a disconnect now between what the front offices are doing and what we get, what we give in the media and what fans get from the media. And that gap is growing right now. I mentioned that towards the end of the book as something that concerns me too, because anytime there's that much of a knowledge gap, does it make it harder for the consumer to actually consume and enjoy the product? But certainly there is you're still seeing a lot of these traditional stats that I rail against in the beginning of the book in newspaper coverage, on broadcasts. It's getting much better. And, you know, you might see OPS on a game broadcast. I don't love OPS. I talk about its flaws in the book, but that's a hell of a lot better than just giving me batting average, home runs, and RBIs. Like, I'll take that. That's progress. But if that incremental change is the best progress that we're getting in terms of how fans are receiving information from their baseball sources, meanwhile, these teams are racing ahead with not just better stats like I'm mentioning in section two, but everything that they're gleaning from StatCast. I worry that we're going to be at a point 5 years from now where the conversation we have about players, media to fans, fans to fans, is just going to be so separate from what front offices are able to do to talk about players. And it's going to be harder for even for folks like me, where I try to be the conduit between what front offices or scouts are talking about. I try to give some of that information to you guys in the audience. It gets harder because, one, because I have to keep learning to understand what they're saying, and two, the educational component of the writer's job increases. More of our time has to be spent then just explaining what the stuff means, and less time maybe talking about the players. And that's particularly hard, I think, in radio and television. Having done a few games just sitting in the play-by-play booth, I did one whole nine-inning game with ESPN this spring. You have no time to explain anything because they're not going to stop the game while you sit there and explain WRC+. Like, they're just going to keep playing. And if you're lucky, you might get to skip one pitch. If nothing happens, you can kind of finish a point, but that's it. You have 30 seconds. You can't explain a lot of this stuff in 30 seconds. And sometimes you have less time. And by the way, you also were trying to make a point about a player where you cited the statistic that then you went on the tangent to try to explain what the statistic meant. It doesn't work in the game format, and that's going to be a challenge going forward. I mean, I think it's a challenge already to try to talk about players in a more intelligent, rational manner at a time when the teams are now racing even farther ahead, even of those of us who kind of sit in the middle, and try to bring that knowledge out to the audience as a whole.
Yeah, I think about StatCast a lot in terms of a couple of things. One, they have more data than you or I could ever imagine coming in through their computers every night. So MLB.com is trying to release, you know, bits of it in, you know, ways that they see fit that can then be interpreted differently by the public. But every club is going to have its own metrics and formulas that we're never going to see. And I think this is the last point at which we will have even anything close to like a fighting chance in keeping up with what a front office knows.
It's 100% true. And well, because they have no incentive to release their proprietary insights. Individual teams, Major League Baseball will, and they do. And that's why they hired Tom Tango and why Mike Petriello is there, because Tom is really an analyst. Mike is kind of does more what I do, in that he's obviously extremely bright and technically capable, but also capable of bringing this stuff forward in plain language, too, to try to explain it to as many people as possible, to try to reach the larger audience, because they view, Major League Baseball views the StatCast product as a product to improve the viewer's experience, and hopefully to get fans even more invested in the game. That kind of directly conflicts with teams themselves trying to use StatCast to find better players, or to, I think even more, to do different things with the players they already have, or players, maybe we got this player from another organization, but we think we can change the grip on a pitch, we can change the launch angle in a swing and get more out of this player than they did. Those insights are proprietary and likely to stay behind the veil, whereas Major League Baseball is trying, like with the barrels statistic, that's one that they've tried to bring public. I think it's a great concept. It's probably still not quite clear enough for the average fan to adopt it, to embrace it. That's probably a better word for it. There's something there, this idea of the hard hit ball that is hit hard enough in a way that we would normally expect it to be a hit or be an extra base hit or even be a home run. We're getting there. I think Major League Baseball is still trying to figure out how to brand and market this stuff, and they don't show that many games too. It's not like they could call every Fox Sports affiliate or every other RSN around Major League Baseball and tell them start using barrels all the time. So they run into a couple of different problems, but I do like that they're so invested financially and in terms of manpower in pushing new information out to the audience. I don't think any other league is doing anything close to that. They use it to justify the huge financial investment that they made in the StatCast product, but also I think they're they view this as a way to compete against other viewing options not even just other sports, to try to get people, again, more invested in the actual product and consuming baseball online. I don't know if that's going to work. I mean, I'm fascinated by StatCast, but that's kind of my job too. It's a huge portion of my life is just dedicated to following baseball and talking to scouts and talking to agents and players and all of that. Does that speak to the casual fan as much? I guess we'll find out. I am hopeful, but maybe not terribly optimistic that it is, because I worry that they're aiming maybe a little too high, going to go over too many people's heads, and potentially risk alienating folks who view this, kind of the folks who won't like the first section of the book, who'll say, no, this is the stuff I grew up with. I don't want new stats. I don't want new metrics. I don't need to know exit velocity. I've heard that from radio hosts. Why do I need to know exit velocity? To which I want to say, I didn't invent the stat. I mean, it's not really my job to defend it. I find it interesting. But there's not an easy answer to that, too. Do you need exit velocity to be a good baseball fan? Probably not. Might make you a more educated one, but even that, I have a hard time explaining exactly what its relevance is, especially without going into a bunch of other stats, too. And say, well, it only matters with launch angle, and it depends on where you hit. That's not a conversation I want to be having. It's not a conversation I think Major League Baseball wants to be having. I think that's too much of a challenge even for them to do, and it's their product, much less for somebody like me who's try to be a bit of an evangelist for the sport. But at the same time, these aren't my stats either, and it's often hard for me to find ways to incorporate them into my work without turning into, like, I don't want to be giving sermons to readers either. So I think that is a marketing challenge for them, even though they're not going to stop. I mean, it's not like StatCast is going away. It's, you mentioned the quantity of data. It's a terabyte and a half of data per season. That was just last year. That could have increased for this year if they're adding more fields. So I joke in the book that I would be unqualified today for the job I used to hold with the Blue Jays. All our data lived on my laptop. There was nothing, everything we needed. I wrote Perl scripts to handle it and ran it in Excel and Access. Now they're running real data warehouses and hiring guys with PhDs in computer science, which I do not have and am not going to have ever. Like, I don't want to write any more code. I'm too old for that. But that shows you how much it's changed, and I think also speaks again to what I was saying earlier about that disconnect between what teams know and what the average fan knows, what teams know and even what the media know, let alone what the average fan knows. And it adds to this whole marketing issue that they're going to have, that I'm glad they're attacking it head on by getting StatCast information out there, but at the same time, I don't think they've figured out the right solution for bringing that information to the consumer to make the end product of actually watching a baseball game any better.
Yeah, I mean, I think about StatCast a lot because I think it's, you know, for a website like Deadspin, I never really know what the audience's familiarity with statistics may be. It's kind of difficult to spend a lot of time trying to think about how to take shortcuts without cutting corners. And so StatCast is something I think about a lot. And I think about, again, I think about my friends who may not be as invested in the statistical side of the sport. And I think StatCast, in a way, I think there are a lot of purposes, at least the StatCast that exists in public or outside of teams. I think one really strong thing it can do is just, again, educate new fans, like Keith said, but also just point out interesting, fun things about the game. Like, I don't really care about exit velocity because it's kind of common sense whether or not something's going to leave a ballpark. I think barrels kind of help explain, you know, why something falls for a hit and why another doesn't. And of course, you know, players like Daniel Murphy are going around their clubhouses saying, let me tell you about this thing, barrels. And if you talk to anyone with MLB.com or StatCast, they'll tell you all about hearing stories about Daniel Murphy, you know, trying to teach his teammates about barrels. But I really think that for a casual fan, I think something like exit velocity, seeing Giancarlo Stanton hit something out of the park at 120 miles an hour is really interesting and fun. But I also wonder, you know, like Keith said, you only have so much time to talk about StatCast or talk about the context of statistics on a broadcast, and StatCast is in the process, or MLB is in the process of rolling out StatCast to different broadcasts or to different RSNs. It started this season on Masson, the Nationals RSN, and I think they're going to try to roll it out to all of the RSNs. I think they told me by the end of a couple years or something. There's a lot of technology that goes into it, but you know, suddenly you're not only getting StatCast on MLB Network broadcasts, but on local broadcasts. And I think there are a couple elements in it. One, most people don't really know the scale of like what is good for StatCast. I mean, if you told me that, you know, a guy was hitting a ball at 95 miles an hour, I'd be like, well, that's not something I can do. You know, I understand, you know, pitching velocity, but still, I don't know. But, and that's one thing I worry about is that, well, it's obviously meant to make stats more friendly to the casual fan. I don't know that the context is going to be readily available on broadcasts. Another thing I think about a lot is whether or not people will be jerked around by the stats that they roll out. I received a big file of data for a new StatCast metric that they're publishing tomorrow called Sprint Speed, which measures speed on the base paths sorted by position. And you know, earlier this year they released a statistic called catch probability, essentially where it measures distance the ball was hit and you know all of that, and tells you how likely it was that the guy or that the you know fielder was going to catch the ball. And I asked them, I was like, so then what happens to route efficiency, which was their big, you know, outfielder stat a couple seasons ago? And I was told, well, we don't really need that anymore because if a guy can get to a ball, then we know that his route was good. Which, yes, it's cleaner, probably more comprehensive and a little bit flashier for them. But no one knew that route efficiency was going away. We don't know if catch probability is going away. And, you know, while it may be more fun to think about catch probability than something like weighted runs created plus, at least those things are fairly peer-reviewed in a sense. StatCast, for all of the smart people that they have behind them, are somewhat rolling it out on a fly.
That's why I didn't, one of the reasons. So I went to do the StatCast chapter, I went to Major League Baseball and sat with those guys I mentioned, Corey Schwartz, Darren Willman, whose site is Baseball Savant that MLB just bought a year or so ago. They were tremendous, absolutely tremendous. Showed me a ton of stuff. A lot of it made into the book, but I did not spend time breaking down individual StatCast stats like what Lindsay was just describing, in part because, well, the StatCast guys themselves emphasized that some of these were essentially in beta. And also because I think if teams have decided what some of this stuff means, they haven't shared a ton of it. I've brought up the example in a few other interviews, radio and print, that I've done so far about spin rate. We don't know exactly what, we certainly don't know what an ideal spin rate is. It does seem to be that having a very high spin rate or having a very low spin rate is good. It's just good to be on the extremes. That kind of makes intuitive sense, right? Hitters just aren't, they have no experience seeing something like that. But then the relationship, they showed me a chart that was just too much to get into the book. But there's really a relationship between, speaking specifically of fastballs, velocity and spin rate. So there are, you know, if you have more of one, you have a little more velocity, you get away with a little bit less spin rate, but you don't want to be average. Even high velocity and average spin turns out to be a terrible thing to have. It's hard to believe that throwing 100 miles an hour could be bad, but Nate Eovaldi, before his arm blew out in six different places, was sort of the living embodiment of just 100 miles an hour. Average spin is terrible. And he was awful, and it was his fastball that was awful because of that. He's one fairly extreme example, but the point I was trying to make and the point that they were trying to make to me with that chart, too, is that it's not a linear relationship. It's not a simple relationship. You can't just point and say 98 is better. 98 is better than 92. Well, maybe. Sometimes 92 is better. 92 with more spin is better than 98 with average spin. But it turns out 98 with low spin might be better than 92 with more spin, and we're not really sure. We got to look at the chart. Turns out that's really great to know if you're in a front office, and I mean, I probably didn't do a very good job of painting a picture for you guys. Imagine trying to squeeze that into a game broadcast or on SportsCenter. I'm going to start to, I mean, you can't. You have no opportunity to talk about this stuff. And there's probably more that they know that hasn't even made it out, more that teams have figured out that hasn't even made it out to us yet. It comes out in dribs and drabs when the Padres talk up Phil Maton, who's one of their relievers now. Big league relievers, I mean. If you go back to when I wrote about him as one of their prospects in their org write-up from January, I mentioned that he had an exceptionally high spin rate on his fastball. I only know that because they told me. It's not like I had the data. A lot of teams don't have minor league data at all, or they simply choose not to share it. And I'm not even sure that that's necessarily what makes him more effective. I know that the Padres think he's more effective because he's got the very high spin rate on his fastball. That's not really knowledge. That's like anecdote versus data. What we really want is data. We want to know for sure, all right, high spin rate means X, Y, Z. Well, we're not at the point where MLB isn't at the point where they can tell us that, and we aren't going to be able to find that out ourselves because we don't have the data set. Even like we had, like Fangraphs has all this great pitch, had all this great pitch FX data. Well, it's because they had the whole file, but MLB isn't sharing the StatCast file because of its size the way that they did with some of the previous data sets.
So you spend, a chapter in your book talking about fielding statistics? Mm-hmm. How many more years do we have until those are pretty much just off the map? Three years?
The quote, I don't remember if this made it in the book. I feel like I wrote that book 10 years ago. And I've been talking about it for 10 years now. One of the analytics directors I talked to, so I asked them all, so what do you think you use ZR, DRS, the public defensive metrics? Are they good? They all said yes, absolutely. They said, for public stuff, that's great, but what we have blows them out of the water. Because the StatCast data tells you, for those who don't know, I apologize, some of you know this, but it tells you at the start of every pitch where every fielder, every base runner, every coach, every umpire, their locations are all in that record for that one pitch. So you can tell how far the fielder had to come. I mean, it ties into catch probability. The teams can do a lot with this data because they have all of it. Where every fielder was to start the play, how far he had to go, where the ball first hit the ground or first hit a fielder's glove. So they can calculate defensive prowess to a much greater degree of precision. So this message I got was that the defensive metrics we have publicly are more directionally correct rather than precise. So if UZR says a guy was worth 10 runs per 150 games, yes, he was probably a very good defender. Was that number really 8, 11, 12.6? Maybe? We're somewhere in that range. So you can feel comfortable saying, you know, oh, he's above average, he was below average, but not going to much more precision than that, whereas what the teams feel like they have is much more precise. And so the question of whether the UZRs, the DRSs go away is largely going to be up to Major League Baseball, which is a little weird, right? We have not typically relied on the league to tell us the stats. I mean, the stats were public record. But the kind of defensive metrics that teams are doing internally now depend on proprietary data that we just don't have access to. So unless Major League Baseball themselves decide to develop a UZR-style metric and share it with everybody, we're not going to get that. And so the answer to the question could be next year, and it could be 10 years until Major League Baseball essentially decides, all right, we're ready to share something with the world. And by the way, if they do that, the teams probably aren't going to be happy because they all think this is their own. This should be kept behind closed doors.
Yeah, forgive me for this, but I think at this point I have enough hitting and pitching stats to, like, I'm satisfied for now. And so the thing that I think about with StatCast, or at least where the future of stats goes, is into speed and fielding. Mm-hmm. I mean, your job is obviously different than mine, but I don't need to think about UZR too often because it's difficult for me to know, like, how precise it will be for whatever context in which I'm, you know, talking about. And so I mentioned this base running speed statistic that StatCast is going to be talking about tomorrow, and it measures a runner's best speed over a second over the course of their season. So the measurement they're using for essentially base running speed, they call it sprint speed, is feet per second because for a lot of reasons using, you know, miles per hour on, you know, an infield doesn't really make sense, but they measure a guy's best single second. And it was really interesting to me to look broken down by position because it's really what you would expect. You know, the center fielders are all very fast. Catchers and DHs are all very slow. Byron Buxton last year could cover 30 feet in a second, which is just wild to me, whereas Brian McCann could cover like 23. So I was telling Keith earlier, Byron Buxton could get three bases in the time, or could get four bases in the time it would take Brian McCann to get three. But I was looking and trying to find kind of the discrepancies between the existing base running stats, mostly through FanGraphs, and the speed stats that StatCast is going to be rolling out. It was pretty consistent. I was telling Keith, like, I spent my flight up here, you know, compiling data and kind of looking through it, and I was, you know, building. I was like, wow, this is going to be cool. There are going to be anomalies. I can say this guy has bad instincts because he's fast but is, you know, running poorly. And it was all pretty consistent, which, admittedly, that is probably something I should have seen coming. But I think what's also interesting is that a lot of the current StatCast or even newer stats kind of just reaffirm the ones we've already had.
That's the kind of info I think, again, it may not get to be public, unfortunately, but teams are or will be using that kind of info on prospects, especially in the draft. Like at the end of July, I'll go to Wrigley. They do this Under Armour game, which is a one-day high school showcase. It's kind of an all-star game of players who, if you look at past Under Armour games, if you look at last year's, like 15 guys from last year's went in the top 30 or 40 picks of this year's draft. So it's all rising seniors, and it's the best of the best across the country. There's a couple of events like that that are played in Major League ballparks, and the teams can have the choice, and they always do, to turn the StatCast system on. And then they can keep that data internally, they can sell it or trade it to other teams. But if you can actually look at high school kids on whom we have historically had no useful data whatsoever and now get sprint speed, exit velocity, launch angle, spin rates, huge thing to get on, spin rates on high school breaking ball, that kind of stuff, I mean, they're already using it in draft rooms. Its use is only going to advance as more of that data becomes available. And I think as teams show that they believe it's valuable too, you'll see more places, maybe even colleges, make the investment in setting up the StatCast system, or at least one of the two systems. There's a radar system and there's an optical system. So they both are installed in all the major league parks. In the minor league parks, they'll typically install just one called TrackNAN. You can install that in a college stadium for, it's under $100,000, which if they decide, you know, if you're Vanderbilt, you're churning out a couple of big leaguers every year, maybe you decide that's worth the investment. And then we'll sell the data to major league teams to try to get some of the money back. And the teams are all going to buy it because they love having this. They love actually having data now where previously they had little on college players or none on high school players or on Latin American players. What if you could get that on the 14-year-olds we're signing in the Dominican Republic? I went down there once and I saw some of those players, and this is a quick digression, but Major League Baseball has their top 30 international prospects for July 2nd next week. I'm going to rank like five. There was one on there who I saw as a 14-year-old. I happened to be in the Dominican Republic doing a story on someone else. And that kid, like I went back to my notes video, that kid is a prospect now? Like he was a child when I saw him. Which means he would have been 14 and a half at that point. There was no data. There was nothing. You could evaluate his swing. I'm not even sure if his swing would be. Does a 14-year-old swing really look like his swing at age 21? But if you can figure out what kind of spin he can get on a breaking ball, if you can get his sprint speed, that seems like data that's not just relevant, but is likely to remain consistent even as the player ages. So yeah, if they can get that kind of information, again, it may not get to us, or it may only get to us after the fact, but I think major league teams are going to find it incredibly useful in the draft room, and that's part of why I talk a little bit towards the end of the book, too, about how scouting is going to change, because now that stuff, you don't have to ask your scouts anymore, or you can ask them, but if I go see a pitcher, I say he's got tight rotation on his curveball, yeah, well, all right, Keith, we can verify that now. You can find out if I'm actually any good at the whole scouting thing. Probably not. Before we go to questions, by the way, I wanted to ask about the piece you wrote on my former site, Baseball Prospectus, which I imagine some folks have questions about. I actually thought it was fascinating. I haven't had any formal affiliation with BP for a long time, certainly not since the sale. But I was curious about just one overall, how that came together and any other insights that kind of didn't make the final cut.
How it came together was I heard toward the end of last season from a few people within BP that they had received an email saying that they were just not going to be paid for August, September, October, I think, something like that. And it kind of seemed like a sky is falling situation, but it didn't seem like something I wanted to wade into. I honestly, judging by the website, I figured this had happened dozens of times with BP. You know, I think the website kind of gives away that there's not a lot of money going around. But during winter meetings in early December, of course, because there's a lot of gossip going around this industry, I heard from all sorts of people saying, oh, did you hear that Baseball Prospectus is going bankrupt? They're going to go out of business, something like this. And I was like, it's not what I've heard. And because Deadspin has a long history of a wide range of sports media pieces, and because my editor-in-chief loves stories that seem to be for no one in particular, I was like, okay, I will pick up writing about Baseball Prospectus. And so I did, and I talked to a good number of people within the company now who really just have a lot of concerns about the current ownership, because the now former president, Jim Walsh, who came in with a few other business partners, I actually heard that the website, when it was sold in 2014, sold for $200,000, which was a figure that I didn't get fully confirmed, but was a number that I found pretty shocking. But he had run a series of annuals called Maple Street Press that began as Red Sox annuals, early 2000s, mid-2000s. And he had expanded it to a few different things. He had made you know, a Dodgers annual, I think an NFL annual, something like that. And quite suddenly at the end of the company, he sold the company and didn't tell anyone that they weren't actually going forward with the next round of annuals, and sorry, no one could get paid. So it left, you know, a bad taste in a lot of people's mouths. And so when he was announced as the new president and one of the co-owners of the site, a lot of people started who had experiences with him through Maple Street Press started reaching out to current baseball prospectus people and saying, hey, this guy screwed over a lot of people I know in a very similar situation, like, be careful. So the writers and editors went into it, I think, with a lot of bad faith. And there was somewhat of a belief that, you know, if he'd kept it as a Red Sox annual, it would have been fine, and he expanded. And so they come in, and the first thing that they say they're going to do is expand to locals. And I know that BP has a Toronto local, and I actually think it's one of the stronger ones. But it just caused a lot of panic. And so immediately, the writers and editors there were very resistant, just hesitant and resistant. And the ownership was just trying to come in and toss around these ideas that they genuinely felt would make the site better, more profitable, all of these positive things. And it just really kind of got off to a rough start. And so by the time last year, when there were 3 months of missed payments, there was just a lot of concern and apprehension, and people hadn't been paid for the annual before. So it's just been a pretty bad relationship on both sides, I think. And shortly after they stopped, or they were unable to pay people, Jim Walsh stepped away as president of the company and told me that he just decided he wanted to spend more time with his family. But it was about a week between the email they sent about not paying people and him saying that he was stepping back. So I don't think I said it in my piece, but it's bullshit. But I think BP is doing okay now. There was just not really much of an explanation given. They said that they had financial issues because the daily fantasy bubble had burst, which was actually something that I hadn't thought about, the kind of cottage industry that would have popped up around daily fantasy that immediately, you know, fell apart 6 months to a year later, and the website redesign, which I'm sure Keith can tell you has been something Baseball Prospectus has been talking about for 10 years at this point.
15.
15?
At least. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, if they've redesigned it, it needs another one.
Yeah. Yeah. In reporting this, I decided to reach out to people who had been with BP along the years because I did not want to say, you know, oh, they didn't pay people for 3 months. This is the worst it's ever been, if that wasn't the case. And there have been a lot of bumps along the way, of course, but no matter who I talked to, especially if they'd left, you know, 5 or more years before and I said, you know, the explanation given was a website, people would just laugh, like, you know, 30 seconds to a minute of just laughter on the phone. So it was pretty entertaining. But the one thing that I think I left out, when I asked, you know, former BP people essentially about the financial health of the company, you know, throughout its course, the one thing everybody wanted to talk about was Nate Silver leaving the company. And there is a lot of bitterness and resentment over the fact that Nate was allowed to leave the company with full rights to 538, because if BP had maintained probably even a tiny share of that, not only would the company be rich, but a lot of people who were, you know, stockholders or part owners of the company would have been rich as well. And there's a certain gravity to it. Everyone will say, well, you know about Nate, right? It's always just Nate. And multiple people told me you could write an entire book about the drama between Nate's departure from Baseball Prospectus, but the person who is really responsible for Nate being able to leave and maintain full ownership of 538 is Kevin Goldstein, who is, what is his title now?
I think he's essentially the pro scouting director.
Yeah, something like that.
If that's not his title, it's essentially his function. Okay.
With the Houston Astros.
He does run pro scouting, so that's essentially the job.
I think his title changed while I was reporting. But yeah, he is someone who is obviously very well-liked, and he just thought, the sense I've gotten is that he felt that 538 was Nate's and was rightfully Nate's to take, and I think he did him a solid and, you know, really teammate-like thing that a lot of people wish he hadn't done so that they could have lined their own pockets, which, depending on how you see it, I think there's a lot of sides to it, but that's the one thing that everyone said I should write more about, you know, write about Nate. Like, does anyone really care?
Before we take questions, the one thing I'll add to, you mentioned the sale price of $200,000. Based on what I got out of the sale, it's probably close, between $200,000 and $250,000. I mean, look, it was nice. It helped me remodel a bathroom. It did not make me rich. I'm here. I wrote a book instead. I'm still not rich.
Yeah, but you should explain why you were a part owner.
Did you get that story?
You told me.
Okay. I wasn't sure. Because I registered the trademark. That was really it. At one point, I was listed as the owner of the trademark. I was the sixth or seventh employee ever. And at that point, the only one, and I'm not a business person, this is not supposed to be self-aggrandizing here, but I said, you know, we should act like grown-ups, right? Let's get a trademark. Let's copyright our work. Let's, you know, register a domain name, like the stupid stuff like that. And it was never my intention to sort of have the trademark be my thing at all, but I was the one who filled out the paperwork, wrote the check originally, and when it came time for them to actually parcel out ownership, I said, they were, in my opinion, I'm sure they would disagree, in my opinion, they were trying to lowball me, and I said, guys, I own the trademark. Technically, I own the trademark. You're going to treat me like you treat everybody else. And ultimately, I was given a share commensurate with all the other people who had been there at the same time and had done the same amount of work. And then I signed the rights to the trademark over. It was the only leverage I had, ultimately. And it was an accident. I never intended for it to be mine at all, but it had to have someone's name on it. If any of you, I don't know if it's different in Canada, but the United States, there actually has to be a person on the trademark. And so for them to get the rights, I had to agree to it. And that's how I ended up getting what I would at least consider a fair share of what turned out to be a very small amount of money.
I didn't take Keith's word for it, though. I looked it up, and it's true. He's not lying. I almost said you're lying, but it's not true.
Not this time. Great. Well, I did promise time for questions, so I don't even know what time it is, but I think we're going to go until about 9:15 or so. So anyway, who would like to start? Red Sox hat back there.
Yeah, I'm so curious, number one, second, I know, what is your offense baseball here? What is your ideal 5x5?
OPS is, it gets its own section in the book. It bothers me because it's a math error, because you are adding two fractions with unlike denominators. We all did that in fourth grade, right? Can't do that. And because but the end result tends to underweight on base percentage and overweight slugging percentage. And I give some more examples in the book, but basically, you know, the guy, the high OBP, low slugging guy gets screwed by OPS. It turns out, however, that OPS at a team level correlates incredibly well with team run scoring, better than either OBP or slugging percentage do individually. And that's worth something. So we don't talk about team OPS very much. We talk about individual OPS, but maybe we should. If you wanted a quick and dirty way to look at a team's offense, look at their OPS. Again, not ideal, but I also try to keep in mind, too, this is a stat that's everywhere now, and I think I said earlier, if that's scant progress, it's still progress. As for fantasy, I have not played fantasy baseball in 15 years now. I mean, I would probably think of something war-based along those lines, something that's just talking about total player value, something that takes defense into account. But I remember, I mean, really the reason I quit was while I was with the Blue Jays, it was too different. because fantasy value is a real thing, but it is not the same as real baseball value. And it was very weird to me to try to almost like keep two spreadsheets in my head of player values. I said, well, one of these is the job and the other one's a hobby. And so now the hobby became the job and then the hobby itself went away. Oh, thank you. They're not here. You can say they're terrible. I want to say, I think from what I've seen at least, the Blue Jays have been exemplary. And I think the industry as a whole has gotten substantially better in the last 3 years. 3-4 years, give or take, on dealing with players with mental health issues. I hear about this a lot with prospects, too. It does come up a lot. Often I don't talk about it. What's that? Yes. Yes. And I think his team handled it well, but I don't think the industry handled it well, and the media handled it horribly. Not that I'm surprised by that at all. But I was saying, you know, often I'll hear about it with prospects who are struggling with depression, anxiety, rarely more serious mental health issues. That stuff often won't come out till after a player's out. If something that's actually preventing the player from playing entirely, might not hear until his career is over. But they've actually, I think this is one of the benefits of seeing the change in the type of person you see populating the front office in baseball. It's a more progressive mindset. It is a recognition that that's a medical issue. You would put a player on the disabled list if his back hurt. Well, if a player has anxiety, that is a medical issue. It can be treated medically, but it's bad enough that he can't play, can't perform at his accustomed level. You would consider putting him on the disabled list for that. You have seen teams put players on the DL with anxiety. You did not see that 5 years ago, I think, ever. I think Greinke was actually on the restricted list. I don't know if that was even permitted at the time to put a player on the DL with a mental health issue. But yes, I'm an anxiety sufferer and have talked a lot about it this year because it's been kind of a bad year for me. Turns out writing a book, not the greatest thing to do when you have anxiety issues. Particularly not changing your medication 2 weeks after the book comes out. I'm thrilled to see how well the industry is handling this. What I worry about, and this isn't specific to Osuna, this would apply to any player, but we'll talk about him because he's the current case, so to speak, is what happens if he comes back and he's terrible? That could happen. And he could come back and be terrible, and it might not actually be about the anxiety, but of course it's always going to be the anxiety now. He's the anxious guy. He's the anxious closer. That's just what the narrative is going to be, and that's incredibly unfortunate for a lot of reasons, but specifically for him, too. Look, I've never played. I can't imagine what it is like to do that, to go and pitch critical, high leverage work in front of 40, 50,000 fans. If he asked me, what would you do? I think the hardest thing to do when you have anxiety and to do something in a moment of intense pressure or attention on you, when you know that everything you are about to do is really critical, is to be able to, anxiety I've described as like the static in your head. It's like having a radio station that's slightly out of tune, for those of you who remember what old terrestrial radios were like, and the signal can't come in clear. There's so much going on that you can't tune into your own thoughts. And every pitcher I've ever talked to talks about the need for focus on the mound. They use different terms, but that is, you're trying to execute a pitch, you're trying to execute a series of physical movements to throw a specific pitch to a specific location that one time, and you want everything to be perfect. If you are not mentally focused on the task, it's not going to work. So the coping mechanisms that work for people, they're going to vary from person to person. But one key to living with anxiety, no matter your profession, is finding a coping mechanism or set of coping mechanisms that works. And to be honest, the ones that work for me today are not necessarily the same that worked for me 5 years ago. And for me, it's going to be a combination of that and medication and other lifestyle changes. But for him especially, what do you do on the mound when that hits, when the static is so loud that you can't think of executing that next pitch? What are the coping mechanisms? It could be a brief meditation on the mound or in between pitches in the dugout. Whatever gets you back to that point where you can focus on the one thing, and I can't tell you what that's going to be, but that's what you need to be able to do. And that might be when if he has to take more time away, that's going to be a big part of it. In addition to medication, which I'm sure he's going through, is figuring out what are the techniques that are going to work for you.
Do you remember what the title of the member of the training staff who's working with him? Is it a sports psychologist? Well, that's something I think about a lot, because most teams now have a on-staff sports psychologist, or I think a couple teams are calling them like mental fitness coaches, mm-hmm. something like that. And I'm not exactly sure what they do, because sports psychology is certainly something different than typical psychotherapy. And, you know, I was reading that and I was wondering, so is he receiving formal therapy or a version of formal therapy, or is this, you know, kind of a hybrid sports psychology, typical therapy type of thing? And one thing I will say before Keith jumps in is that I think the Cubs are the only team who have a Spanish-speaking sports psychologist on staff.
When I was with the Jays, and I know for at least several years after, if a player had an issue like that or had a substance abuse issue, we had a person who I think was actually a trained psychologist who... we called it EAP, Employee Assistance Program. He was it. That was the lone resource, and it was, as far as I know, always on the player to seek him out. There was not a mechanism for anyone else to help, but that would be more an issue for substance abuse than for mental health. Although I guess you could if you thought an intervention was required, but that was it. That was the only resource available. But I may be out of date. I just bring that up because that's my own experience, but that could be easily be 7 years out of date at this point.
Yeah, I looked it up over the offseason, and I think just, you know, across the league, everything's still fairly limited, as I'm sure everyone's here probably aware.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm an idiot, and the first day I started at Deadspin was the day the company went up for auction. I don't know why I thought it was a good idea, but it turned out fine. So, yeah, I missed most of the... is everyone up to speed? Deadspin is owned by, or was owned by, Gawker Media, which went bankrupt when Hulk Hogan sued the company and won a judgment of, I think, $100 million. Mm-hmm. So Gawker no longer exists, but Deadspin does. And the company was sold to Univision. But I wasn't there during the trial, but by my understanding, it was just a really tough and terrible time. Since the company, we were bought by Univision, and there have been a lot more resources, apparently, than there were when, you know, it was independent media. And there are a lot of pros and cons. Like, my editor encourages me to find stories to fly across the country to pursue now. We can actually pay freelancers or pay more freelancers and things like that. But there is a lot more bureaucracy. But because I wasn't there before, I mean, I'm very happy. But I am very happy to be part of an editorial union, and especially to have not had to go through the process of building the union myself, because obviously it protected everyone after the company went bankrupt. You know, we have in our CBA mandatory severance and all of these things. So if the company had been sold to a buyer who decided to shutter all of the sites, everybody would have at least been somewhat protected. But it's also been really nice under the new ownership, which is Univision, which is honestly, for, you know, big media, I think it's about as good as it could get. But there have obviously been a lot of changes, and people have, you know, and they've tried to come in and make changes. And because we're in a union, you know, we're very much able to push back on that. And obviously that's the, like, obvious strength of a union. But I really think it has really made all of the difference. And I think Deadspin, Jezebel, Gizmodo, and all of these sites, I think they would be very different than they are now if Univision had their way every time they came up with an idea for us to change something. Does that answer your question?
No,
I was at BuzzFeed before, and it's a company that treats people very well, but I still believed that union protection was the way to go. But I pushed, and it was really difficult, and especially I think what makes it difficult for the web is there are so many different types of jobs. You know, it's not like a traditional newspaper, and so there was no real way for me to figure out how to organize, because there's a video department, there's a news department, there's a non-news department, and so it was really difficult. But they are, you know, BuzzFeed is really the one media company right now that I think it's really important to unionize so that it sets the industry precedent, and especially we never know when the bubble is going to pop again and we're all going to be out of jobs. I will say, if you're interested in the Gawker bankruptcy thing, there's a new documentary on Netflix called, I think, Nobody Speak, that lays it out pretty well.
Sort of. And I hesitate only because I don't know if any of these advantages are real. Teams are trying. And the Dodgers in particular, they have, as far as I can tell, the largest analytics department in terms of number of people. They have also, with the help of a local venture capital outfit, set up a fund to provide seed funding primarily to sports-related technology startups. The idea being the Dodgers get the stuff first. They're certainly the most aggressive at doing that. So it's close to what you're asking. It's not exactly the same, because I don't know that there's new data in terms of like player statistics to be able to get, other than that TrackMan type stuff that, like I said, third parties are going to start offering. But I think it's this idea that, like, you've heard about these MODIS sleeves that pitchers can wear that might give you biometric information. There are so many companies out there trying to offer stuff like that. I look at it all, I mean, my initial reaction is this is all snake oil. But the reality is some of it's probably useful. I just don't think we know what. And a bunch of teams with money and resources like the Dodgers, will just try it, figuring if 1 out of 10 works, it's still worth it to us. I have no idea which ones of those are going to turn out to be useful.
Yeah, actually, I wonder about that. Like, do you think teams are actually jumping onto that? Because when I see, like, Carlos Correa, you know, pimping for whatever one it is he does, I don't remember, some sports technology thing, I wonder, like, is this an individual player thing getting from these agents, like, okay, do this so that we can make you the most money, or is this teams?
Weren't the Giants partnering with some? That was woo. That was no question pseudoscience, some brain head whatever.
Is it the neurobubbles
thing?
The like Russell
thing.
Wilson thing? Yeah.
If Russell Wilson
dangerous.
Is in it, then it's bullshit.
That
yes,
is
clearly.
Truly, I mean, a sleeve is one thing, but like messing with that is dangerous.
Yeah. I mean, like, I argue with anti-vaxxers voluntarily. I did not think I would be arguing with pseudoscience people in the day job. But that came up with Jay Billis, a coworker of mine, is a paid sponsor of one of those neuro, like, brain training things that's supposed to raise, like, lumosity. They're all, they're fake. It doesn't work. Obviously, it doesn't work. Idiot could have figured out they didn't work. And I got into an argument with Jay on Twitter. It was like, there's research that this doesn't work. And I was actually floored that we allowed him to do the sponsorship, because we have quite a few rules on whether or not we can endorse a product at all. But yeah, this stuff does pop up, and a lot of it, I mean, these are bad examples in that they're obvious nonsense. But there's going to be a lot of these that's, hey, it's a good idea, it just didn't work out. And if you're the Dodgers, you have the money you can throw at that. And if you're the Rays, you'd probably love to try all of these new toys, and maybe don't have the money, even if you get the equipment for free, because they just want to try to seed the market and get somebody to adopt it, you need people to actually handle the data, you need coaches who are up to speed on how to use it, the pitchers have to buy in. It's just easier to do that if you're a large, not just a big market team, but a big resource team. I got you already. You can come later. I don't think it'll be homogenous. The whole industry has shifted to some extent, right? We're just seeing teams, more high strikeout teams, more teams going for power. We were just talking about that with the three true outcomes stuff. Defensive shifting is just, now everybody does it. 5 years ago it was weird, now everybody's doing it. But there are still teams looking for, because you're not going to win by doing the same thing everyone else does, especially if you're the Pirates or the Rays and you're dealing with a limited budget anyway. You're going to have to find some advantage. I think we're at a point now where everyone has kind of rushed to the same point to get to where everyone else is. But from here, I would expect to see increasing diversity of strategies. I pointed out 2 years ago that the Pirates seem to have decided in the draft, and I think they've continued this the last couple of draft classes, they're going to focus on hitters who never strike out, which really is contrarian at this point, right? Because we're not supposed to care about strikeouts. But they seem to be taking it to a fairly extreme level where they were even taking hitters who maybe didn't have a lot of other tools but never struck out. Now, that may not be a good strategy, but it is a strategy. It's at least somebody's trying to do something different and swim in the opposite direction. And I think teams are going to have to do that because, like I said, I worry long-term about competitive balance in the sport. Now that the data advantage is gone and now that you can't just outspend, you can't be what the Pirates and the Royals used to do and just spend more in the draft and spend more in Latin America. It's the only way we can keep up with the Yankees and the Red Sox. You can't do that anymore either. So what possible avenue is still open to the lowest market, lowest revenue, lowest payroll teams? They're going to have to find some competitive advantage that they can milk for at least 2 or 3 years until everyone else catches up. I was very fortunate when I worked with the Blue Jays to work with some people, including Tony LaCava, who's still here. He was truly a mentor to me. Tommy Tanis, who's now the scouting director at the Mets, he was our area guy in New England where I lived at the time. After 2 years with the Blue Jays, it became very clear to me that the analytics work was useful, but by no means the only answer. And that I was at a real disadvantage in a lot of discussions of players, whether in the draft room or talking about pro players, if I didn't have any kind of scouting background, even just the ability to understand the jargon. And so asked those guys and some others if they would teach me. Could I just go to games with them? They would all come through the Cape Cod League, which was a commute for me. I lived in near Boston at the time. I would go and just watch players and ask dumb questions, and they gave me a radar gun, and probably terrible at it for a few years, but that's kind of what you have to do, especially in scouting where it really is about what you've seen before. What you've seen before informs your evaluations now. So now I can go see a player and I've got probably 12 or 13 years of players in my head to go back through and say, well, he reminds me of this guy and this guy. Well, that guy, I like that guy, but it didn't work out. Well, he's got a similar swing, so maybe that's not going to, maybe what I thought was good isn't going to work. I mean, that is really what scouting is applying all of these heuristics, consciously and even subconsciously, based on what you've seen before. So I'm glad I started when I did. You know, I wish I could go back in time and start 5 years earlier, because maybe I'd be a little further along than I am right now. But I had to get out and do it. And it was because I realized that what we were trying to do, relying too heavily on analytics, I even hesitate to call it analytics, we were really just relying on the stats at that time, was not going to give us enough of a competitive advantage. And ignoring scouting really, I think, ended up putting us at a disadvantage, especially in the draft, where I think we just got out-scouted by a lot of teams because we didn't put the resources into it and because we totally eschewed high school players for those first four drafts while I was there. Travis Snyder was the year that I left, and that was when they finally opened up the approach and at least gave themselves the possibility of acquiring better players that we'd completely cut off the previous couple of years. In the back there. That's you, yeah. Not the brick wall. I think they're the Cubs are absolutely the best example of integrating all of this, but especially integrating analytics into all aspects of the business. They have a separate analytics department, but if you talk to Cubs people, front office people and coaches and scouts, they're kind of all involved. They're not necessarily all doing the work necessarily, but they all are absolutely speaking from the same playbook. They understand what analytics is there to do. They're comfortable with it. It informs their draft process, their pro scouting process, their international process, the major league coaching staff. It's just everywhere. And I think that's a huge part of the culture of the Cubs and that Theo and his guys were successful at implementing in the Red Sox too, that has even lasted past Theo. It's even still there. I mean, Dombrowski is not seen as anybody's stat head, but I know a lot of those Red Sox guys, they're still operating kind of the same way. I think Dombrowski certainly hasn't gone in and changed it. And it's a testament to what Theo is able to do as a manager, that he's able to implement that kind of culture within a front office and have it last that long after he left. What I couldn't speak to maybe as well is, I think the comments you're talking about, we're also talking about the culture in the clubhouse or the culture of the players. And I always struggle with the question of, do you have a great culture because you won? or did you actually build a great culture? Like, I don't know, you know, is Joe Maddon a great manager because he had great players, or is he a great manager because he's a great tactician? Well, it's probably a little of both. I actually thought he got outmanaged in the World Series last year, but he won. So a lot of people will say, well, he was the better manager. I'm not so sure about that. I think Joe Maddon is great at dealing with players. He's particularly good at dealing with young players, which is absolutely a skill. That's something he clearly has. Maybe he's the reason that they have a great clubhouse culture, because it's such a young roster, and because that seems to be his real forte. Is that to his credit? Does that go to Theo's credit? Because when Maddon became available, he fired Rick Renteria and said, I'm going to go get the better guy? Well, yes, I guess so, recognizing that that's the right manager for this, for the type of roster we're going to build. Sure, I could spread the credit around for that. But what exactly that comprises in terms of putting a clubhouse together is probably something I don't think I've been around the Cubs enough to be able to answer.
I think one thing you might be interested in, a friend of mine, Jared Diamond, wrote a story for the Wall Street Journal, I think last month, maybe 2 months ago, about the Cubs circular clubhouse. Have you seen that? So instead of like a traditional like rectangle clubhouse, the Cubs have something that to me looks like a nightclub. It's a circular clubhouse with a big like thing in the middle for food, and then a big weird cub on the ceiling. But it's I believe Jared wrote that the Cubs consulted with, I think, a psychologist to talk about how to implement kind of a better social culture literally in the clubhouse. And one thing he mentioned is that starting pitchers are all still next to each other in their lockers, but they kind of switched up the seating chart to an extent to put, you know, first baseman next to maybe a reliever or something like that, instead of, you know, grouping guys how they typically are found in clubhouses, so that there's a little bit more, you know, cross communication and camaraderie across the team. And, you know, it's impossible to measure how big of an impact something like that has on it, you know, has on a team, but it's creative. You know, at least they're trying, at least they're saying, like, you know, just because of the, you know, your position doesn't determine who you talk to in the clubhouse. And I think it's, if you're looking for a good read on that, I would check it out.
Sounds like a Montessori approach to
right.
A clubhouse. So now your turn in the back. Yeah. Get out. Just get out. He got fired, by the way. I just want to point, and I'm still here. South Carolina. Yep. That's a huge, I mean, I could talk for an hour on that topic. The insularity of the college coaching world as a whole, and there are a few standouts who are actually great. I know some of them. A lot of them reach out privately. Florida's coach is great. LSU's coach is great. Vanderbilt is great. It's funny, the scouts don't like him. Like, they keep churning out players. What's not to like, right? Even some junior college, there are individuals out there who get it, but as a whole, they don't, and they really insist on seeing their game as a thing apart from professional baseball, which I don't know if that's true in other sports. I don't follow other sports enough, but I mean, Major League Baseball needs to improve its relationship, but also put its foot down a little bit more on the college ranks too, and say, your best players are coming to us, and we come to your ballparks to scout and eventually sign and pay your players. So there needs to be a little bit more, we need to be working together more developmentally. We need to be working more towards keeping pitchers healthy, which I don't know if you saw John Manuel tweeted the other day. There was an NCAA working body that was talking about we might have to implement pitch counts, but the coaches association was against it. Yeah, no shit. They want those, and it's because coaches don't want to surrender control. It's not even because they don't care about keeping pitchers healthy. Some do, some don't. But they don't want to surrender control. That's the issue. But a minor league coach who runs his best pitcher out there for 125 pitches is going to get fired. Now, I'm not saying a college coach needs to get fired. I may say that on Twitter, but I'm not saying that here. If he does that. But at the same time, too, there needs to be some accountability. There needs to be some kind of, again, a better relationship, an idea that for some of these college players, particularly at the better schools, this is not the end. This is a developmental step. And if you want Major League Baseball to at least encourage some of the better high school players to go to college, hey, you know what, we'd love to sign you, but we actually think you're going to be better off going to Rice for 3 years. Well, Rice has to be a better place for you to send your kid. And that's, we don't have that now. And the fact is, like, I've even tried to, more than once, tried to write about what Rice does that blows out so many of their pitchers. Unfortunately, I can't get enough people there to kind of talk on the record to talk about what they're doing wrong. But the fact that they don't care about how many pitchers they're blowing out, that to me is the bigger problem. That they don't see, they see Rice baseball as the last step. This is the only end, as opposed to, for some of you it is, and you're going to get a great education, it's a great academic school, but for some of you, this is the next step before pro ball. And that's a real disconnect, a substantial disconnect that I don't think Major League Baseball has done enough to try to repair. Got to wrap in 5 minutes. I will sign some books, and then we'll continue the conversation next door at Mill Street. That's actually important, but we're not going to take that. It seemed like there were two different drafts, too. Like, almost like they were by two different groups of people, too. I really disliked their draft 2 years ago and said so on draft day, except for Bo Bichette. But really, I thought they went... it was almost like they decided, as if they decided that going for toolsy college players was somehow going to be, despite poor performance, was going to be, maybe they felt that was a contrarian approach. I don't know the answer to why. It was a bad draft, and it looks like a bad draft. Whereas this year, at least, it seemed like they went for a bit more of a conventional approach. The one thing I can say for certain, though, is that Tony LaCava was not really involved in the draft process a year ago, but he was this year. In fact, I saw him at the ACC tournament. Obviously, we have a long-standing relationship, so I went to chat with him, but also walked away like, they're taking an ACC hitter. There's no way you're sending Tony LaCava to the ACC tournament if you're not, one, taking a player from there, and two, it's going to be a hitter, because Tony is like the swing guru. That's his, hitting mechanics is one of his things, always has been. So I took that as a huge positive. If you have a brain like that, a guy with that kind of scouting and player development experience, I would absolutely want him involved in the draft process, even if it's just for the first two rounds. Just have him parachute in and say, hey, here's 20 guys we need you to see in this draft class, but they're targets for us for the first couple of picks. 100, actually, they had the two high picks, right? And then their second round pick. So three on day one. Even if that's all you used him for, you'd be insane not to do that. But my understanding is that in the 2016 draft, he really wasn't involved at all, which to me makes no sense. And it sounds like they agreed and got him back involved in the process this year. All right, we'll do one more question. I think the issue is time. That's been the issue that's come up for me, at least, when I've done television, whether it's play-by-play or even doing when we still had Baseball Tonight, when I would do that show. I always wish I had kept some of these rundowns that we would have. So before the show, typically the show's an hour long, we would get maybe three pieces of paper that would describe everything that was going to happen in the show, and it would be carved out into segments, sometimes as short as 20 seconds. And it might be 20 seconds, Keith on Tebow. And that's literally all you have to make whatever point or points you wanted to make on that player, on that team, on the news story of the day. And sometimes you don't even get the 20 seconds. It's a separate issue. But if my point being, if I want to talk about a player and say he's got the fourth highest exit velocity, his weighted on base average is 412, and therefore you're out of time. You don't have the chance to explain the stats. And there's no interest, and I'm not blaming anyone, but there was never any interest in us taking 5 minutes out of a show and let's walk through some sabermetrics concepts. We did try to do that a couple years ago when Jonah Carey was still with, when Grantland existed and Jonah would come on the show, and it never clicked. It just did not resonate, and it's not on Jonah. But it became didactic, and I think that just didn't work with the viewer. And it also tended to, it was a real huge change in the flow and tone of the show. Everything's moving fast. We're talking highlights. We're talking players. Now let's take 5 minutes or more and discuss kind of high concept stuff. I like that, but it's a very different show, and it's going to reach a different audience. So there are a bunch of challenges that are, but to me, they all come down primarily to the amount of time that people are willing to devote to educating about concepts rather than talking about players, and also what the viewers have at least indicated they're willing to listen to. That's not a very optimistic way to end, unfortunately, but we are out of time. So thank you all for coming. I'm going to be, I think, sitting up front to sign books for everyone who's got them. Really appreciate everyone coming out and listening to us ramble for an hour plus.